You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a $42 million medical center is slated to be built near the site of the Foxconn technology plant currently under construction. We'll talk about that announcement during our roundup of state news. First, between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and the morning show. You'll be able to find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today we're talking to Dr. Jennifer Vipond, a pediatrician from Elm Grove, running as a Republican in Wisconsin's 5th Congressional District. Dr. Vipond, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, you have take a half a minute or so to pitch yourself to voters in the district and tell them why you're running.
Well, as you said, I'm a pediatrician. I work in Waukesha, and I entered this race because we need a sensible approach to health care policy. For years, Congress has issued policies that really shift rather than reduce health care costs. We have Obamacare. We have the Republican bill. Neither of those are health care bills. Those are health insurance bills. In the meantime, absolutely nothing has been done to actually control the cost of health care. Health care costs are skyrocketing. Families are being crushed. Small businesses are being crushed. And there is not a sensible solution to this problem that I foresee. And I see every day families who are less and less able to afford health care. And I just want to make a difference and take 6 years out of my practice, see what I can do to make things better, and then get back to work.
What kind of policies do you think the federal government could enact that would tackle those, as you say, healthcare costs, not just shifting around how costs are paid for?
Well, for example, I work for ProHealthcare, and we have a group of Medicare patients that we treat differently. We have a different way of looking at their cost and their billing. So we've partnered with insurance companies. We do what's called population health, where that cohort of patients, we get a set payment from the insurance company. We are responsible for their health care. As a result, we look at a holistic view of their health care. For example, if you're in that group and you have diabetes, you don't just see the doctor twice a year. You're contacted by nurses. You work with nutritionists. You have people talk to you about your exercise schedules. There's technology connections. Looking at your whole picture so that when you do come back to see the doctor, there's been some progress made in the meantime. Working with this method has saved 28% on that group compared to comparable Medicare patients in a usual fee-for-service program. And we do something similar with Medicaid patients at the 16th Street Clinic in Waukesha. The 16th Street Clinic runs a clinic that's for uninsured and low-income people. They take care of 18% of Waukesha's Medicaid patients and use only 3% of the Medicaid money. Again, it's a population health-based approach, partnering with the insurance companies. It reduces costs. It also improves outcomes, better quality metrics, better care overall. And that's just one aspect of it.
Now, before we dig into some other issues, I want to get into some of the other things that Congress will be facing. But you're running as a Republican challenger to longtime incumbent James Sensenbrenner. How do you make the case to Republican voters in the 5th District that it's time for a change to carry the Republican standard?
Well, you know, I respect Sensenbrenner's service to our community. He's been there for 40 years. But at this point, I feel that there are some issues that are not being adequately addressed, healthcare being the number one. I live in the community. I work in the community. As a pediatrician, I have seen the devastation from the opioid epidemic, and I have not been impressed with the sluggish response from Congress. My first patient who died of a heroin overdose was in 2008, and in that time, there has been little done, and what has been done has not been given funding. I don't know that when you're that separated from your community, you see the devastation that's wrought and you see the urgency. While they're dragging their feet, 115, 125 people are dying every day. In the meantime, Big Pharma lobbies, and there's been some decisions made in Congress that really should have had physician guidance. For example, in 2015, when they unanimously stripped the DEA of its ability to block huge, questionable shipments of pain pills. I mean, this worsened the epidemic. If there had been any physician guidance in those discussions, they would have known that, you know, for example, Williamson, West Virginia didn't need 21 million pain pills for its population of 3,000. I am not supported by special interest money. I am not supported by Big Pharma. I'm able to look beyond special interest money and actually do what is best for the constituents of District 5 and of the United States.
Talking to Dr. Jennifer Vipond, a pediatrician from Elm Grove, talking about her campaign as a Republican in Wisconsin's 5th Congressional District. Dr. Vipond, stepping aside from health-related issues for a moment, immigration is a big issue, an ongoing issue in Congress, border security, legal outcomes for DACA recipients. What are your views on these immigration issues?
Well, our immigration system is completely broken. And before we do anything to fix it, we need to secure the border. If there's not a border security plan in place, which includes some physical structure, some technology structure, if we don't have that first, there's no sense fixing immigration. Once that is in place, we need to put together a reasonable approach to immigration. I think there should be some merit-based immigration, and I think the DACA recipients should be given a path towards a green card and then citizenship, with limited family migration along with it.
And the president has increased tariffs, and we're seeing back-and-forth tariffs with a lot of countries. We're hearing from some Wisconsin farmers and others that they're already feeling the impact. What are your views on the president's tariff plans?
Yeah, I think it was a mistake to put tariffs on our allies. I think with our allies, we would have been much better off starting with negotiations. With the EU particularly, we put tariffs, they counter-tariffed. At the end of it all, we dropped all the tariffs, and now we're negotiating. We should have started with negotiation because we need our allies to go up against the real bad actors like China. So I would say negotiate with our allies, save the tariffs for the foes such as China, the true bad actors, the people who are stealing our technology.
Staying with jobs and the economy, we've seen this long, gradual recovery from the Great Recession. But there are concerns in Wisconsin and around the country that wages haven't gone up along with that, both under President Obama and under President Trump. Any economic proposals that might help that?
Yeah, well, I've met with many of the school superintendents to talk about workforce development. And one of the problems that we have right now is an acute lack of skilled workers for some of our businesses. And I think wages would go up if we had a better supply of skilled workers, and because those skilled workers would be paid better. I've met with the school superintendents talking about ways to promote programs that take high school students who might not be ready or willing to go to college, put them through tech and trade programs. I've seen programs where high school students get out of high school with, you know, two certifications in tool and die. They're put in with businesses, the schools are partnering with businesses, and these 18-year-old kids come out of high school with a good career, a good paying job with good benefits and a good future. And I think that's the way to increase the wages, is to develop a better skilled workforce in our area.
Do you see any issues really specific to Wisconsin's 5th Congressional District that you think are maybe being overlooked in Washington?
Well, I think the dairy farmers are really being hurt. They have lost so many markets, and now with the tariffs, they're really at risk. And the thing is, you know, some of the major corporations can weather the storm, can hold out a year or so while the tariffs are working or not working. But the farmers can't. The farmers are family farmers. You know, a year without income is devastating. And I don't think they're getting enough attention, certainly not from Congress at this point.
And as we start to wrap up, if you were elected as a Republican, do you see areas where you could cooperate potentially with Democratic colleagues in Congress?
Yeah, and that was another reason why I entered this race. We have such a polarized Congress that there's very little movement going forward. And in order to move our country forward, we're going to need to work together. So I honestly see a lot of places where I could have some overlap with limitations.
What limitations do you see?
Well, for example, with gun violence, I believe that we should have red flag laws, which are laws that remove guns temporarily from people who are suicidal. And I believe that we should have background checks if you sell to a stranger. So for online sales, there should be background checks. I wouldn't go beyond that. I do not believe in a ban on semi-automatics. I don't believe in a federal registry. But I think those two places, if we could come together on just those two issues, it wouldn't affect gun violence as much as it would affect suicides, which is the cause of 60% of gun deaths are caused by suicides.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Vipon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. Jennifer Vipon, a pediatrician running as a Republican in Wisconsin's 5th Congressional District. Between now and the August 14th primary, candidates who are running in contested primaries have the opportunity to join us here on the Ideas Network. You can find all of the interviews we've done so far at wisconsinvote.org. It's time for our weekly review of state news. The police chief in DeForest is facing possible termination and allegations of racism after a video he made was posted on YouTube. A new medical center is being built near the Foxconn plant in Racine County, and a Milwaukee reporter was arrested and detained for trespassing while working on a story. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, let's start, Rob, with this story out of DeForest. The village board there took a step toward ousting the city's police chief, Dan Furseth. He's getting scrutiny since the posting of a video he took in 2007. And we'll hear some of it right now in the video. A group of African-American men wearing suits are walking from their car toward a Steak and Shake restaurant. And this is Furseth adopting a stereotypical voice to mock the man watching from his vehicle. Here's a listen.
I got my suit. Oh, baby, I got a car llama, my impala. All right, boys, let's go in. This is the fanciest restaurant we ever been to, and it is called the Steak and Shake. Unbelievable.
So, Rob, what kind of response and consequences has Furseth faced so far?
Yikes. I mean, not great. Yeah, so the guy's the police chief of this small town, and it looks like he's going to get fired over this. It's sort of weird how it came about. So as you mentioned, the video itself is 11 years old, and it was apparently posted on YouTube in December 2015 by somebody who says he was a former intern at the DeForest Police Department. And so it was just out there on the internet until earlier this year, apparently, when apparently what happens is Furseth became aware of its existence and went and told the village administrator about it, and he was placed on paid leave at the end of May. And then this week, the village board there voted to make a formal complaint against him, and the village president says that they plan to fire the guy.
And it wasn't just about this video. It sounds like there were other areas of concern from the board.
Right. So they had they did an inquiry. They had an investigation that was triggered by this video and the questions it raises, I guess. There were several other incidents involving Furseth or his department that the board said it considered in making its decision. So this is according to a reporting from the Wisconsin State Journal. They said that he neglected to address harassment complaints that had come to him, and there was a time when the department posted video to its Facebook page of a naked man running around in a McDonald's parking lot. Sort of a like weird, wild thing, except that in reality, this was somebody who was like in the throes of a mental health crisis. And so you could argue that there's a certain insensitivity to having local police post that. Furseth had a video. He obtained a video that was part of evidence in a case that showed a woman running away from her husband after the husband had shot her in the head. And Furseth apparently showed that to officers in other departments and to people who were not even with the police department without having authorization. So they have several things wrapped up in this complaint.
And before we wrap up, has the chief there, who's apparently on the way out, has he responded publicly to these stories?
So he spoke to the investigator, and that report was made public. He said that he regretted making the video, that he's changed and changed in his views since it was made, and it was 11 years ago. He also rejected an offer for a severance deal from the village that it would have been, I think they said it would have been worth $120,000. So he declined that. So he's fighting it out, or he's running out the string on this.
Moving to another story, it was announced yesterday that a new medical center is going up in Sturtevant. That's in Racine County, not far from the Foxconn technology plant under construction. Rob, what do we know about the plan?
Right. So this is from Ascension, Wisconsin, a $42 million medical center. So like a clinic, some specialty care centers. It's not a full hospital, but I mean, it's nothing small either, right? And it is, in fact, only about 2 miles away from a planned $250 million hospital campus from Advocate Aurora Health. Ascension also says it has other plans. The total plans for the next 3 years is to invest about $100 million in this campus, and that is all very much attributable to projected population growth as a result of the Foxconn project.
Governor Walker has talked about a Foxconn effect, he says, creating economic development beyond the plant itself. Do you think these medical center developments will be part of will be heard about on the campaign trail?
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, look, this has been part of Governor Walker's case for the project from the beginning, which is this is a gigantic project. It in itself generates a whole bunch of jobs. Then there are related industries, you know, suppliers and so on that get an economic boost as a result. And then the next step after that are these service industries like health services and other totally separate economic sectors. But it sort of lifts everyone up. The population has to actually grow, right? They haven't actually built these things yet, but certainly it's a sign that these companies see that as a bet they're willing to make.
Rob Mentzer is with us from USA Today Network Wisconsin, rounding up news from around the state this week. Moving to Milwaukee, Rob, Edgar Mendez, a reporter from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, who's been with us on Central Time before, was detained this week while working on a story. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, we don't like to see this, Rob. So Mendez was taking photos of police cars. He was photographing the police cars in a parking lot that belonged to the Milwaukee Police Department, and he was trespassing. He was not supposed to be there. But it's worth getting into the specifics of this. This is according to Mendez. He was taking these photos. An officer walked by. Mendez said, "I'm a reporter. I'm taking photos in my capacity as a journalist." The officer waved him on and walked on. Then he saw another officer. He waved to that guy, and he finished up what he was doing. He got in his car and drove away, and then got pulled over. Then said, "Oh yeah, no. I'm a journalist. I was taking photos for the story." And then they said, "You're going to get a ticket for trespassing." They took him back to the station, handcuffed him, took his fingerprints and everything. And this is the argument. His point of view is that this was excessive, and that if they just said, you're not supposed to be here, you can't take photos here, he would have just left.
And have we heard responses from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service and or the police department on this?
Yeah, I mean, the Neighborhood News Service definitely has been in, they're supporting their reporter here, and he's been pretty outspoken about calling this excessive. This is interesting. They posted on in the Neighborhood News Service's story about this. They posted a shot from Google Street View and showed where the actual no trespassing sign was posted. It really is something that would be easy to miss. The rule for a photographer is always that you can take from a public space. So like the sidewalk is always the safe place to take photos. But it's in this case it's a public building, public department. So you could see how you could think, well, I'll just go in the parking lot, it should be fine. But it wasn't. But I think it's at least a question of whether he should have known that or not. The police have been a little quieter on it. They said that they are dealing with heightened security right now. The Milwaukee Police Department has had the fail shooting of an officer quite recently. And so, okay, that's, you know, that is understandable. But I think that for the most part there, the spokespeople's response has just been, well, we're aware of this case. We're looking into it.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Rob, an update on something we've talked about in the past on Central Time. Two spaces in UW-Madison's Memorial Union getting attention after it was discovered that their namesakes were part of a group called the Ku Klux Klan during their time on campus in the early 20s. And now those names, it looks like, are being changed.
Yeah. So the right. So we have been through the process. UW-Madison looked into this. The social group, the Ku Klux Klan, was not formally affiliated with the KKK that we know. But on the other hand, why was it called that in the first place? So anyway, they're going to change the name of the art gallery named after the art historian Porter Butts. Is going to be called the Main Gallery, and a play circle named after the actor Frederick March is going to be renamed the Play Circle. So they're just taking names out of it.
We'll leave it there, Rob. Thanks for joining us again.
All right, thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us to recap some of the week's news from around the state. The use of big data in the public and private sectors has been growing for years. That includes lots of information about us, what we do online, what we buy, where we live, whether we've been in jail, how many times we've been married, the list goes on. A lot of marketers use it to try to sell stuff to us, but it turns out the health insurance industry is paying more and more attention to that data. Health insurers say that right now they're not using data to price health insurance plans, but patients and privacy advocates worry they may start in the near future. Marshall Allen reports on healthcare for ProPublica. He reported the recent investigation titled "Health Insurers Are Vacuuming Up Details About You and It Could Raise Your Rates." Marshall, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, how did you first start tackling this issue of health insurers really being interested in a lot of non-medical data about us?
Well, I got a tip about this from a woman who did data analysis for a big insurance company, for Aetna. And she told me that while she was working at Aetna, she was given access to a database that had a bunch of information about people's hobbies. And it had information like whether or not you crocheted, or whether or not you were into knitting, or whether or not you were a gun owner, or the type of food that you like to eat, or the type of outdoor activities that you like to participate in or not. And she said it just felt very invasive to her, and she knew that the members of the health plan had not given their permission. They hadn't given their consent for her to be looking at this data. And she said the goal was, you know, to use this data to try and figure out how much different people might cost the insurance company to cover. And so that led me to dig a little further on it. And what I found is it's kind of an open secret. You know, it's been going on for several years where the insurance industry has teamed up with data brokers, and they are gathering all these personal details about our lives, and they're feeding them into these complex computer algorithms. And then they're trying to use that to predict who might have higher health costs than other people. So basically, they're using non-medical information to make inferences about our healthcare costs.
Now, you've ended up at a convention, basically, where some of these insurers were and where this industry, these big data companies wanting to sell stuff to insurers were. What kind of promises were these data companies making? What did they say you could do with their stuff?
Well, you know, they are real proud of their work. So, you know, they put it all out there in their marketing materials and their sales materials. And I went to a big health insurance conference and kind of walked the floor of the vendor hall and talked to a lot of people there. You know, the big companies, one of the big ones is LexisNexis, who your listeners have probably heard of. They're a massive research organization. They're also, you know, what you'd call a data broker. I mean, they're taking personal information, whether it's public information, so say from court records or property records, or they can also get proprietary information about things maybe that you've purchased or Whether or not you have debt or whether you have recently lost your job or you've moved. And they have, they said 442 of these socioeconomic attributes that they use to create what they call their health scores. And some of the inferences that they and these other companies make are really sort of interesting because, you know, it could be true. You could see for a group that some of these things could be true, but any individual in the group, it may not be accurate, you know. So, for instance, one of their assertions is that if you're a woman who's recently changed your name, which they could tell from public records, maybe you would be newly married, and so you could have a pregnancy pending, or maybe you're recently divorced, and so you're stressed out, which would also cost higher medical bills. Another one of them is if you're a woman who's purchased plus-size clothing, the industry considers you at higher risk of depression, and obviously mental health care can be expensive. Or if you're low income and you're a minority, then the data brokers are sort of interpreting you as someone who is more likely to live in a dangerous neighborhood, and that could also increase your health risks. And the problem is, you know, this may or may not be true for any of these individuals in these groups. And so even when I was walking the floor of the convention hall, you know, one of the salesmen for one of the other companies was like, you know, God forbid you live in a bad neighborhood these days because you're going to get lumped in with a lot of assertions about your health.
Talking to Marshall Allen from ProPublica, talking about big data and how health insurers are using it. Marshall, can and do health insurers use this kind of data, these kind of programs, to set an individual's healthcare premiums right now?
Well, so the people at LexisNexis are adamant that no one would ever use their data this way. No one would be interested in using their data this way. Their contracts forbid using their data this way. But then I looked at a press release that Milliman, the giant actuarial firm, put out where they said they're using this data. So I called Milliman, and they told me that they are using the LexisNexis health scores to try and figure out whether they would be useful for pricing healthcare plans. Now, the Affordable Care Act, so I did not find evidence that they are using it to price healthcare plans, but it's an obvious, you know, insurance companies are in the business of trying to figure out how much we might cost and predict risk. And especially with the Affordable Care Act, you know, they're offering plans in new communities where they don't have the medical history of patients. And so they are more interested in finding everything they can about the potential risk. The Affordable Care Act does protect individuals on individual plans and small group plans from this information being used to price plans. However, you know, the Trump administration is pushing the short-term plans where they don't have the same protections about pre-existing conditions. And so this information could definitely be used there. It could be used to price groups. You know, if there's a large group plan that an employer is buying, they could look at all the people in that group. They could look at their socioeconomic factors, and they could use this to price those plans. So, you know, in different situations, they're not allowed to, but in other situations, they are allowed to.
Another concern raised in your reporting is that, okay, if I'm an insurer, I'm looking, hey, do I want to open up business in this market or that market? Do I want to participate in Affordable Care Act exchanges in this state, in this part of this state? And if I've got this bundle of data that says, oh, these neighborhoods over there aren't looking so hot, maybe I don't want to bother competing in that neighborhood.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. They are using the plans to assess communities. And, you know, part of that assessment is to think through how big is the risk. And, you know, in some cases, it might be accurate, you know. So it's, you know, and obviously they're allowed to do their business. It's just that the risk of discrimination is there. And also the industry has a lengthy history of doing what's called cherry picking patients. You know, they want to pick the healthiest patients so that those patients are paying premiums and then they're not having medical expenses. And they want to avoid the sickest patients. They want to avoid the patients who are going to be filing claims. And so there are a lot of shenanigans that the industry plays even today to cherry pick patients. For instance, I talked to someone at Harvard Law School. They have a whole organization there that analyzes the different plans that are put out under the Affordable Care Act to see if they discriminate. And they found commonly that the different plans that are put out now under the Affordable Care Act will do things like limit the number of specialists in a network. So they would not have specialists in network who do like HIV care or care for patients with hepatitis C. And then, of course, patients who need that type of care would not sign up for that plan. So it's a way to avoid sick patients, or they would make the drug formulary unclear. So you can't really tell whether or not they cover an HIV drug. And of course, if you're an HIV patient, you need your HIV drugs, which are expensive drugs. And so if the formulary doesn't show you and give you the information you need to know if your drug is covered, you're going to avoid that plan. So there are still ways that the industry plays little games to attract healthy people and to repel sick people.
We're talking to Marshall Allen from ProPublica about his reporting that shows health insurance companies are starting to, continuing to look at people's personal data and lots of it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how this works? Are you worried about this? Do you worry that health insurance providers might use data like this to discriminate against patients, against communities? Do you worry about being stereotyped for a divorce, where you live, buying a self-help book? Or do you think it's not a big deal? The data's out there. Somebody might as well use it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. ProPublica reporter Marshall Allen is with us talking about health insurance companies and how they're using big data. Lots of information about what we buy, what we do, where we live, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you surprised to hear that health insurers are looking at and using all this data about us, not directly medical data? What questions do you have about what they do with this, what they could do with it? Are you concerned about what's happening with information about you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Marshall, you write that the case from some of these health insurers is that, okay, we don't care so much about the individual patients here, but if we can take this kind of data, correlate it, well, then we can help individual patients by providing them the services that they need for their, what our algorithms tell us are their health needs.
That's right. This is part of a movement in medicine called the social determinants of health. And it's the idea that people's economic conditions and their social conditions have a lot to do with their overall health. And there's certainly a lot to that. There are studies that show that, you know, your education background, the neighborhood you live in, the type of food that you eat, all these things definitely contribute to your health. And so their argument is we can use this for better case management, and we can create programs for people who might be in a low-income neighborhood, or maybe they have difficulty getting transportation to go to the doctor. If they know these things, then they can help meet these needs. The catch there is that, you know, there are ways of doing this that are transparent, where you have the patient's consent. You know, like a lot of healthcare providers will just have a patient fill out a survey, you know, like, do you have a hard time affording your medication? Or do you have a hard time making it to the doctor? Do you need transportation? You know, if a patient provides that information on their own, then they know that they're disclosing it. They know how it's being used. They can decline to provide the information if they think it's not the business of the insurance company or the doctor. And that's one way of doing it that I think would be okay. You know, I mean, it's out in the open, it's disclosed. But what's going on here is that they're teaming up with data brokers who are really harvesting all of our personal details about our lives without our consent and without our knowledge. And then they're making these inferences about our overall health and really ranking us and rating us by how much we're going to cost to cover using non-medical information. So there are ways that people are using the social determinants of health that are really positive. And then there are ways like this that I think a lot of people would say are more problematic.
Let's go to our callers now. Garrett is on the line in Madison. Garrett, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say, Marshall, you bring up some really interesting insight from some of these attributes or subsets of attributes that the insurance companies are using here. But I also wanted to kind of bring up concern and see if you can speak to the validity of some of these ancestry companies like 23andMe, or I know there's some other ones out there, the names escape me, but Can you speak to the validity of them acting as data brokers? It sounds pretty dangerous, as the data that they have might be a little bit more direct.
Garrett, thanks for the call. I don't know if you looked at those ancestry testing services. Do you know, Marshall, how that fits into this data collection?
So I did not actually dig into that at all. I did not report on that at all. But I can tell you that, you know, you want to be really careful that you read the fine print. Call the company and ask them how they're going to be using your data. Are they going to be selling it or sharing it? I'm sure that they would say it's all de-identified. But once you put your information out there, I mean, you know, things can easily get re-identified. I mean, they know. They can put together a few different data points and figure out who people are pretty easily. So I personally would just urge people, if you care about privacy, ask a lot of questions, find out how things are going to be used. And, you know, I tell people, like, online, just don't be on Facebook if you care about privacy. I mean, anything that you post online, there's going to be a record of it.
Garrett, thanks for the call. Jason is with us now in Minocqua. Hello, Jason.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
And what did you want to ask about?
Well, I have been debating with my college roommate from Madison now for years about who owns the information about you. And it seems like in his high-tech world, the corporation can own everything there is to know about you, and that's okay. But on my side, it looks to me like, you know, there should be some boundaries there. And I wonder if you could offer an opinion on what boundaries in privacy we should enact.
Jason, I gotcha. To what extent, Marshall, do we own our digital selves, our digital shadows?
Well, the United States has pretty much made it open season on our personal information for corporations and data brokers to traffic in all these personal details about us. Europe has a really interesting contrast. They have this general data protection law that they put into place. In Europe, they basically assume that your private information is to be protected unless there's some exceptional reason why it needs to be shared. In the United States, we generally assume that your private information is available to every corporation to trade, except for certain exemptions like our medical information where it's protected. So Europe takes a completely opposite point perspective than the United States does. California just passed a law that's more restrictive, but that law doesn't go into effect for many years, and it could get chipped away as they put it into place. But this is a big debate that we need to have in this country. And basically, the corporations have been running away with it without a lot of public conversation.
Jason, thanks for that call. Marshall Allen is with us from ProPublica. We're talking about his reporting on the way health insurers are using big data, lots of information about us, and fears that they could use it to set insurance rates in the future. We'll go now to Taj in Wautoma. Taj, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I wanted to say that it doesn't surprise me at all that these corporations are doing this. It's a matter of them lobbying for the laws that work in their favor. And, you know, until people actually push their, you know, their representatives to, you know, talk about this and make laws that are in our own interest. Like, you know, he said, it's in our best interest to have this debate.
Thanks for the call. Marshall, you mentioned California. At the federal level, is there anybody sounding the alarm, trying to pass legislation to change things?
Not that I've heard of. I think a good model here might be the way we deal with our credit scores. You know, a lot of experts I talked to pointed to the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And as everyone knows, you know, we have a credit score that is used when people give us loans to determine our credit worthiness. And the difference here is that we can find out our credit score. We can find out what factors are used to give us our credit score, and we can also petition to have it changed if we find something wrong. The difference here is that they're creating health scores. We're not allowed to have our health scores. In fact, I asked LexisNexis if they would give me my own health score. And they said that if they had figured it out for me, they would, it would be the property of my insurance company, not me. And so there was no way for me to actually even find out what my score is or what information they were using to calculate it.
In our last few minutes, Marshall, you did get at least part of your, I don't know what to call it, dossier from one of these data providers. I think it might have been LexisNexis. Not the whole shebang, not everything they have about you, but what did you get?
Well, so LexisNexis does make it available for people to request their own file, and any of your listeners can do that. If you go to my story at ProPublica.org, I put a link in the story, so you can look up your own data. And they don't give you everything. They only give you the very limited number of things that the federal law requires them to provide. And it was really interesting. I got this 182-page report in the mail. It was really like a walk down memory lane for me. You know, I saw all my old phone numbers, all my old addresses going all the way back to my childhood home in Golden, Colorado. I mean, this was information going back for decades. And kind of an interesting detail on the addresses. Now, you know, I've lived a really middle class, fairly boring existence. You know, I don't have a criminal record. I don't have any anything shady on my record. But, you know, they had a little field on the addresses for whether or not the address was considered to be high risk. And mine were not high risk, but it did make me wonder, you know, what if I had lived in these high-risk neighborhoods? I mean, what if, you know, 10 years ago I lived in a place that was considered dilapidated and dangerous? Is this the kind of thing that they're holding against us? You know, I mean, it would be nice just to know.
We'll leave it there. Marshall, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on today. I appreciate it.
That's Marshall Allen, healthcare reporter for ProPublica, talking to us about his investigation into health insurance companies and their use of big data. You can learn more and check out some of those links Marshall talked about at ProPublica.org. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll look back at a key turning point in Latino activism here in Wisconsin. An expert on conspiracy theories joins the show to tell us how they start, why they spread, and why it's so hard to convince true believers that they may be wrong, and to tell us if the internet changed the way conspiracy theories start and spread around the world. Plus, Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine is back with us. She'll share some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. On the agenda, I don't remember all the things. There's one looking for a supernova, right, where a star really explodes. We're starting to look, we astronomers, are starting to look for signs of a major supernova. And we're going to meet, this is a discovery not long ago in Utah, one of the biggest cousins of the dinosaurs. This thing is huge. That, plus a look at some of the top news of the day. It's all coming up Monday right here on Central Time.